Cassette 3, Side 2. AIDS had come to Kanje about 2 years after he had, back in 1985. He was writing about its arrival in his thesis. He would catalog what he called the geography of blame and the scapegoat role assigned to Haiti. He'd tell the story of how, early in the AIDS epidemic in the United States, sociologists and even medical people had hypothesized that HIV had come from Africa to Haiti, then to the United States. Some experts even hypothesized that the disease had originated in Haiti, where, it was said by some, voodoo hungans ripped the heads off chickens and guzzled their blood, then had sex with little boys. He'd write about how the Centers for Disease Control, a federal U.S. agency, had gone so far as to identify Haitians as a risk group, along with several other groups whose names began with H, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and heroin users, and about the incalculable harm all this had done to Haiti's fragile economy and to Haitians wherever they lived. In his thesis, he'd marshal a host of epidemiological data to show that AIDS had almost certainly come from North America to Haiti, and might well have been carried there by American and Canadian and Haitian-American sex tourists, who could buy assignations for pittances in a Port-au-Prince slum called Carrefour. The thesis was to be an interpretive anthropology of affliction, combining evidence from ethnography, history, epidemiology, and economics. It would begin, though, with the story of Kanje. Following anthropological tradition, he'd give the village a pseudonym, Dokai. Sitting on the hilltop on a rocky outcropping, he wrote, "The best view of Dokai is from atop one of the peculiarly steep and conical hills that nearly encircle the village. From where he sat, Kanje looked like a collection of small dwellings scattered in no particular pattern on the side of an almost treeless mountain. There, near the top, was the house of Dieudonné, empty now because he'd died of AIDS last October. Over there, near the road, was the house where Anita Joseph had died of AIDS, slowly. A lot of painful memories were incorporated in the landscape. He remembered many other patients who had died, along with their lab data, and remembered vividly three young Haitians who had worked with him on the first health census of Kanje. Asifi, picked off by malaria. Michelet, by typhoid. T-Tap Joseph, by puerperal sepsis. Good medicine could have prevented all those deaths. Each friend had died while in the care of doctors, in the typical substandard Haitian medical facilities that Farmer had come to loathe. But it wasn't as though failure and death were all he could see from his perch. He could see the clusters of trees that marked the sites of Kanje's communal water fountains, connected to the sparkling clean underground river. He could see some of Père Lafontaine's communal latrines, which had all but eradicated typhoid in this village. He could see some of the hillside on which Zami La Santé had grown, and picture the rest. The dormitory and church, and the office of the public health project, and a corner of the school. And behind the groves of trees he'd planted, the guest house, the artisan's workshop, the substantial building that housed the Clinique Bon Savour, rebuilt with Tom White's money. And looking back at the village itself, he saw a settlement no longer made of crude lean-tos. Kanje had grown from 107 to 178 households, and the hillside was dotted with little houses now. Père Lafontaine's wife, Mamito, the matriarch of Zami La Santé, had supervised a home improvement project, distributing materials that Tom White had paid for, and quietly arranging for the reconstruction of the worst of the dwellings. Most of the houses had only two rooms, and many still had dirt floors. But nearly all had roofs of tin, some painted, some rusty, some glinting in the bright sunlight. 6 years since he'd first set foot in Kanje, and it no longer looked like a miserable encampment of refugees, but just a typical, extremely poor Haitian village. Farmer received his Ph.D. and M.D., simultaneously in the spring of the following year, 1990. His thesis won a prize, and a university press accepted it for publication. Early on, certain professors at the medical school, especially the eminent anthropologist Arthur Kleinman and the equally eminent child psychiatrist Leon Eisenberg, had taken a shine to Farmer and licensed his unorthodox habits of attendance. And as the years went on, they and others would protect him from the enmities and rules of academia. Lives of service depend on lives of support. He'd gotten help from many people. Farmer's absences from Harvard hadn't hurt his educational standing. For his graduate work in anthropology, Haiti had been a better site than Boston, obviously. And his grades in medical school were outstanding, in part because while studying his flashcards, he'd also worked for large portions of 6 years as a virtual doctor in Cange. By now, at the age of 31, he'd dealt with more varieties of illness than most American physicians see in a lifetime. He'd also learned how to design and manage both a public health system and a clinic, built from scratch, in one of the most difficult places imaginable, among people whose governments had kept them illiterate, where on a good day, concrete got transported by donkey. Not surprisingly, the Brigham and Women's Hospital accepted him into its residency program. It was one of the world's most prestigious and flexible. A Brigham resident could get permission to pursue another interest. Farmer and Jim Kim, whom the Brigham also accepted, split a clinical residency. Farmer got formal permission, that is, to spend half his time at the Brigham and the other half in Cange. It seemed possible that Haiti might have a real national election late in 1990. Clearly, though, it wouldn't happen without a fight from the army and the Duvalierist elites and the paramilitaries who worked for them, usually at night. Returning to Cange from Harvard, driving north from Port-au-Prince to Cange, Farmer had to pass through 5 different military checkpoints. At each, soldiers routinely solicited bribes. Occasionally, they confiscated medical equipment that he was bringing to the clinic. Not all the harassment was routine. Zami La Santé kept an office in Port-au-Prince. Several times in the months leading up to the election, the phone would ring, and a voice on the other end would ask for Farmer, then say, for instance, "You're going to be reunited with your granny's bones." He could hear loud clicks on the line when he picked up the phone. Farmer climbed up on the roof of the building, found the bugging device, a clunky-looking jury-rigged thing. Rather gleefully, he kicked it to pieces. This was all slightly puzzling to him. He hadn't played a visible role in politics. Perhaps he had come to the Army's attention because, whenever his patients got arrested, he would go to the jails and try to get them out. Soldiers at the barracks in Mirebalais had shoved him around during 2 of those attempts at what he called prison extractions. Or perhaps he cut a larger figure than he realized. It was possible, for instance, that the wrong people had spotted him in the company of Aristide. In 1990, he saw a lot of the by-then famous priest. One day, when Farmer happened to be in the city, Aristide stopped by the Zami La Santé office, looking bedraggled, driving a white pickup truck with a load of flour for his orphanage in the back. The truck wouldn't start, so he and Farmer loaded the flour into Zami La Santé's van and took off. They hit a large puddle. The van stalled, and Farmer said, "I don't think we're going to make it." Then he said to Aristide, "In the newspaper it says you're going to be a candidate for president. I guess they don't know you very well, because you would never run for president." Aristide said something noncommittal, and a week later declared his candidacy. For a while, Farmer felt angry. How could he participate in something as irredeemably filthy as Haitian politics? But then he thought, what are the Haitian people saying about this? They're demanding that he run. In a journal Farmer kept during this time, he wrote, "Perhaps this is a singular chance to change Haiti." Soon he was rooting ardently for Aristide, like virtually everyone else in Cange, and like them, listening almost constantly to the radio dispatches from the capital. He was in Port-au-Prince along with Père Lafontaine on election day. Many foreign observers, including Jimmy Carter, certified the results. 67% of the vote for Aristide, and only 33% for the 12 other candidates. In his journal, Farmer exulted. Haiti had not only the most popular elected head of state in the world, but one who professed liberation theology and had promised to lift the country into dignified poverty. The new president had also promised, not very subtly, a change of fortunes for the Haitian elite. The rocks in the water don't know how the rocks in the sun feel. said a Haitian proverb. In one of his speeches, Aristide had revised it, saying, "The rocks in the water are going to find out how the rocks in the sun feel." Farmer drove back to the central plateau the next day. Entering Cange, he spotted an elderly man climbing barefoot up an eroded hillside, wincing, imagining the man's feet being sliced on the shaly rock. Rocks with teeth, as the local people said. He had a somber thought. I wondered fleetingly what even a government of saints and scholars could do in the face of such odds, he wrote shortly afterward in his journal. But exultation returned. To Farmer, Aristide wasn't the real victor. It was, he thought, the Haitian peasantry, people like his friends and patients in Cange, who had really won the election. They'd braved intimidation, even massacres, to make it happen and to vote. It seemed as if, at last, after centuries of misery, of slavery, and subsequent misrule and foreign interference, the people of Haiti had claimed their country. Nothing, he would later say, had ever moved him so deeply. He had many reasons to feel hopeful when he went to Boston to put in his time at the Brigham in the summer of 1991. Rumors of coups abounded. One real attempt was aborted, but the new government had assumed power. When he drove to the airport now, he didn't have to stop at army checkpoints and roadblocks. They were gone from National Highway 3. What seemed like a revitalized Haitian Ministry of Health had begun collaborating with Zami La Santé on AIDS prevention work in the Central Plateau. And at long last, it seemed that a real hospital might be built in Cange. Indeed, most of the money had been raised. On the 29th of September 1991, a date he wasn't apt to forget, Farmer got Jim Kim to cover for him at the Brigham and set out on a short trip back to Haiti for a meeting about the new hospital. These days, a lot of Boston's cab drivers, as well as its janitors, were Haitian. The cabbie who picked him up at the Brigham happened to be both Haitian and an acquaintance. As he drove Farmer toward Logan Airport, he said over his shoulder, "Dr. Polo, there's trouble down there." No way, Farmer thought. This government has the most massive popular support of any in the world. He said to the cabbie, "Don't worry, I'll be in Haiti tonight." His route was a well-worn path. When he landed in Miami, he went to the usual gate for Port-au-Prince, but the sign above the check-in desk read, "Canceled." "Whatever for?" Farmer asked the woman at the counter. "I have no idea," she said. He checked into a motel near the airport and tuned the TV to CNN, which was just then broadcasting the news that the Haitian army had deposed Aristide. Farmer sat up all night watching, stupefied. He waited around for flights to resume, then got word that he couldn't take one anyway. The new authorities, the junta, had put his name on a list of personae non gratae, so he returned to Boston. Day after day for 2 months, he called the La Fontaine's in Haiti, asking, "Can I come back yet?" Finally, in early 1992, he was told he could. Père Lafontaine had bribed a Haitian army colonel to expunge Farmer's name from the list. When he got off the plane in Port-au-Prince, he was drenched in sweat. He thought, "My pheromones are announcing fear." But he made it through immigration without incident and drove straight to Cange, through the many reconstituted military checkpoints. 2 days later, he was working in his office at the clinic, beginning to feel calmer, when a former TB patient of his, a young peasant woman with a baby, came in speaking frantically. The local authorities had beaten her husband. "He was dying," she wailed. Haitians were always dramatic, though. Imagining a few broken bones, Farmer packed his doctor's bag and went off with her. They hiked across the dam to a hut on the other side of the reservoir. To protect the victim's family, Farmer would give his patient's husband the pseudonym Chouchou Louis. Later, he'd learn some of the background to the story. While riding in a passenger truck through the Central Plateau, Chouchou had made a disparaging remark about the state of the road. Inside the truck, there was a soldier out of uniform. He overheard Chouchou's point, his pointed comment, and interpreted it correctly as anti-junta, pro-Aristide. At the next checkpoint, in the town of Domond, soldiers and members of a civilian group called attachés hauled Shushu out of the truck, took him inside the headquarters building, and beat him. Afterward, they let him go, but his name went automatically onto a blacklist kept by the local branch of the state security apparatus. Shushu lay low for a while, but when he tried to sneak back home, the local section chief and an attaché were waiting for him. They had finished their business, and Shushu was lying on the dirt floor of his hut when Farmer arrived. He did all he could with the equipment he had in his bag, but even the Brigham's emergency room would probably have failed. Afterward, Farmer recorded the wounds. On January 26th, Shushu, a handsome man in his mid-twenties, was scarcely recognizable. His face, and especially his left temple, was misshapen, swollen, and lacerated. His right temple was also scarred, although this was clearly an older wound. Shushu's mouth was a coagulated pool of dark blood. He coughed up more than a liter of blood in his agonal moments. Lower down, his neck was peculiarly swollen, his throat collared in bruises, the traces of a gun butt. His chest and sides were badly bruised, and he had several fractured ribs. His genitals had been mutilated. The accounting continued. That was his front side. Presumably, the brunt of the beatings came from behind. Shushu's back and thighs were striped with deep lash marks. His buttocks were hideously macerated. His skin flayed down to the exposed gluteal muscles. Many of these stigmata appeared to be infected. The people who did this probably weren't far away. Farmer didn't dare go back by the same route on foot over the dam. He borrowed a canoe, a hollowed-out mango tree, from a local fisherman, and he paddled it back across the lake. Farmer had to get the story out. He contacted Amnesty International, which added Shushu's name to a growing list of victims of the junta, and he wrote a piece called A Death in Haiti, which the Boston Globe agreed to publish under someone else's name. To classmates, later to his students, Farmer's medical memory seemed encyclopedic and daunting, but it was not inexplicable. "I date everything to patients," he told me once. Patients, it seemed, formed not just a calendar of past events, but a large mnemonic structure in which individual faces and small quirks. He'd remember, for instance, that a certain patient had a particular kind of stuffed animal in his hospital room, were like an index to the symptoms, the pathophysiology, the remedies for thousands of ailments. The problem, of course, was that he remembered some patients all too well. In later years, he didn't like to talk about Shushu. He told me, "I take active precautions not to think about him." By then, he'd already described the case in print several times. To me, he simply said, "He died in the dirt." Chapter 12. Ophelia visited Kanj during the time of the junta in the early 1990s. She slept in the main dormitory over the communal kitchen. One morning when she came down to breakfast, Paul said rather casually that someone had stood outside his window last night striking matches. She'd often felt nervous in Haiti in the turbulent years after Duvalier was thrown out. This was worse. When they ran into soldiers at checkpoints and roadblocks, Paul wasn't even civil to them. He would not take down the iron sculpture that hung in his small room off the clinic, the Aristide symbol of the coq qualité, the fighting quality cock. He would leave his books about Che Guevara and Castro and the like unhidden. She thought, "It would be dreadful if they came and searched the place." She lay in bed at night, listening to the dogs barking and the roosters crowing and the drums beating in the hills. One evening, she awakened as headlights swept through the louvered windows of her room. The next morning, people said that soldiers had been poking around Zami La Santé in the night. She thought, "The Plateau Central is the home of the resistance, and there's no way to get out of here except that road, and everyone knows that this place is full of Aristide supporters." She asked the woman in charge of the kitchen. She was known as Iron Pants, a generic Haitian nickname for a tough woman. "What if they came in to massacre us?" Iron Pants said, "We'll defend this place with our lives." Ophelia thought, With what? Our pots and pans and Culligan water cooler? Paul continued to make the edgy transit between Cange and Boston. Indeed, he made it edgier. He asked Tom White to give him $10,000 in cash, which he planned to smuggle into Haiti and turn over to the underground pacifist resistance. In the car, driving back with the money from Tom's house on Cape Cod, Jim Kim said to Paul, "You're no use to anyone as a martyr." He tried to soften his tone. "If you get yourself killed, pal, I'm going to kill you." Paul's face turned bright red. "What the fuck do you want me to do?" Paul had yelled at him before, but Jim had never heard him scream. Paul smuggled the money into Haiti. Safely back in Boston, Ophelia fretted about him in Cange. He was so angry he might do anything, she thought. What if a soldier came into Zami La Santé and tried to arrest one of his patients? Oh, God! He seemed to be growing more and more reckless. He invited some nuns from the Catholic group Pax Christi to Haiti, hoping they'd help advertise the junta's depredations. Twice at roadblocks, soldiers searched both him and the nuns. One time the soldiers ordered him to get out of the jeep and say, "Long live the Haitian army." "I'm not going to say that." "You better say that." They lifted their weapons. "Okay," he said sweetly. In Cange, he slept in his clothes, with his shoes on. His room was adjacent to a piece of thickly planted ground, reforested by him. He imagined what he'd do if the soldiers and attachés arrived. Jump out the window and hide among the vines and trees from the beams of their flashlights. This was morally acceptable, he thought, because they'll be coming for me. Then one day, a lone soldier started to enter Zami La Santé carrying a gun. Farmer came out to the courtyard. As always, a crowd waited there. "You can't bring a gun in here," Farmer said to the soldier.
"Who the fuck are you to tell me what I can do?"
"I'm the person who's going to take care of you when you get sick," Farmer answered. He was feeling mildly amused, until from the crowd behind him, he heard a voice say, "Ket," in rough translation, "Oh, shit." It had the sound of someone anticipating disaster. Farmer thought, "Oh, God, I misjudged the situation." The crowd suddenly seemed like a liability. The soldier couldn't back down in front of them without losing face. But his answer to the soldier was probably the right one, and probably contained the main reason that he wasn't banished or worse during those years. In fact, he was the best doctor in the Central Plateau, and Zami La Santé was the only place where anyone, including soldiers and their families, could get good medical treatment. The soldier growled some menacing words, then left. Farmer's Haitian friends and colleagues scolded him. After that, he curtailed his travel. Shots had been fired at Zami La Santé's office in Port-au-Prince, and Père Lafontaine had decided to close it. Farmer stayed out of the city, except when catching planes back to Boston. He received his MacArthur grant in the summer of 1993, when it seemed that the junta might always be in power. He went to the awards ceremony in Chicago, but soon afterward went back to his hotel room, hiding, as he thought of it, and watching the news from Haiti on TV. He was sitting in his room feeling wretched, thinking, "Big deal, I just got a MacArthur. Oh great, my star's ascending as the Haitian sets," when he heard voices outside. Haitians? Of course. Who was more likely to be cleaning hotels in the States? He went out and chatted with them, which cheered him up a little. In Haiti, the body count kept growing. Three close friends of Farmer's had been murdered. He asked Ophelia to give him some money, and he went to Quebec City, his favorite of all cities. He'd always loved snow. In 10 days in a hotel room, he wrote 220 pages, most of the draft of a book he would eventually call The Uses of Haiti. It is, I think, the best of Farmer's books, certainly the most passionate, essentially a history of American policy toward Haiti. The history, that is, as if written in collaboration with a Haitian peasant. The perspective is interesting. One learns, for instance, that the United States tried to help the French put down the Haitian Revolution in the 1790s and, during the time of American slavery, refused to recognize Haiti and practiced gunboat diplomacy there. Also that, during the American occupation, the U.S. Congress had reconstituted the modern Haitian army and helped to finance it right up until the time when it deposed Aristide. That the head of the junta's death squads, whose minions had murdered Shushu, had been trained at Fort Benning's School of the Americas. That some of the junta's henchmen and officers in the Haitian army also worked for the CIA. That while formally deploring the coup, Washington, with the help of a generally compliant mainstream American press, was busily denouncing Aristide, even manufacturing lies about him and maintaining a leaky embargo that seemed calculated to preserve appearances, but not to drive the junta out of power. In the book, a number of heroes don't look so fine. The French revolutionaries, whose idea of fraternité didn't include the slaves in Saint-Domingue, and the Haitian mulattoes, who went to France to aid those revolutionaries in the hope that they could win the right to own slaves themselves. Woodrow Wilson, who presided over the American invasion of Haiti. Even FDR, who once boasted that, while serving as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he had written the Haitian Constitution of 1918. There were others on this list whom Farmer often mentioned elsewhere. The former American slave and great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who eagerly served as American ambassador to Haiti, in effect representing the Monroe Doctrine there. And Mother Teresa, who came to Haiti in 1981, during the time of Baby Doc, and as one historian put it, gushed over the profligate dictator and his widely hated wife, Michelle, who had looted millions from the Haitian treasury for her worldwide shopping sprees. Mother Teresa said Michelle had taught her a lesson in humility and marveled at the closeness of the First Lady to her people. In the United States, there was talk that the new Clinton administration might send troops to put Aristide back in power, albeit with conditions, such as accepting plans for structural economic adjustment. In early 1994, just before The Uses of Haiti came out, Farmer wrote an editorial for the Miami Herald. The gist of it was, "Should the U.S. military intervene in Haiti? We already have. Now we should do so in a new way, to restore democracy." The editorial was mentioned in Haiti on government radio. Farmer was said to have slandered the Haitian government. Soldiers came looking for him to escort him out of the country, but he was already in Boston. He was formally expelled again, this time with a finality that even bribery couldn't undo. "I would have expelled me too, were I them." He moped around the PIH office. Ophelia bought him a guitar, and he actually took some lessons, until the news came that yet another friend had been assassinated in Haiti. Jim half-carried Farmer home, weeping and puking from a bar that night. The next day, Farmer gave away his guitar. For the rest of the summer of 1994, he lectured about the situation in Haiti to anyone who would listen. In small towns in Maine and Texas, Kansas and Iowa, usually staying at the houses of church ladies. He testified before a congressional committee along with some nuns, but most of the congressmen were asleep. He debated an American general. "I basically just let it rip," he said later. "The Haitian situation is not understandable unless you know that the U.S. created the Haitian army. Blah, 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 infectious disease." The general's main response was to yell at him, "Paul, you're totally out in left field." Most of the sources Farmer had used in his book were American government documents. He'd imagined that he could merely say he was a doctor, and he had written about things he'd either seen with his own eyes or had looked up, and he'd be believed. He was well received in some quarters, but usually not on the radio. During a show in Fort Lauderdale, a caller said, referring to the boatloads of refugees who were fleeing the poverty and violence in Haiti and trying to get to Florida, "We can't have Haitians coming into our country." "Why not?" Farmer said. "My family are boat people." The host, understandably, didn't get it. "Dr. Farmer? Are you Haitian?" Several times, and especially after the general yelled at him, he thought, "Screw this. I want to go back to my clinic." He returned the day after Aristide was reinstated as president in mid-October 1994. The 3 years of military rule in Haiti had resembled a war, and like every war, produced a public health disaster. The United Nations estimated that about 8,000 people got killed, most of them murdered by the Haitian army and its paramilitaries. Many boat people, perhaps thousands, drowned while trying to get away, And more died than on the Titanic, when a leaky old ferry named the Neptune had sunk. But deaths from drowning and gunshots and torture probably made up just a fraction of the total. There was no telling precisely how much public health had deteriorated by the time military rule ended, but Farmer could make some guesses, based on the wreckage he returned to in Cange. Somehow, Père Lafontaine had managed to get the new hospital built. But all Jean-Mille La Santé's projects in the villages around Cange had been interrupted. Its programs for women's literacy, for vaccinating children, for sanitation and clean water, for distributing condoms and other AIDS prevention measures. Partners in Health had financed a movie about HIV. Patients created the script, which depicted a truck driver and a soldier romancing several female victims. It was being shown to a crowd in a village school when soldiers walked in and shut down the projector. Not the wisest thing, during the reign of a military junta, to show a movie that blames AIDS on soldiers. Jean-Mille La Santé had put the movie away for the duration. In the region, only Jean-Mille La Santé had dared to treat people who had been beaten or shot. The army had shut down the clinic once, briefly. The place was marked. Afraid to be seen there, afraid to travel at all, lest they end up like Shushu, many patients hadn't come until they'd grown very ill. Many had simply stayed away. The number of patients fell by half during those years, yet the clinic recorded an annual doubling of injuries from assaults, including 4 rapes committed by soldiers and attachés. A large increase in typhoid, and 22 times more cases of measles than the average before the coup. The years of military rule had exacerbated the chronic malnutrition, and tuberculosis had risen markedly in the region. The junta had focused most of its terror on the urban slums, because some of Aristide's most ardent support was concentrated in them, and the slums were also at the center of Haiti's AIDS epidemic. Hundreds of thousands fled back to the countryside. At Jean-Mille La Santé in 1993, the number of patients with AIDS had increased by about 60%. Several of the staff had resigned in fear. Farmer wrote that paralysis and lassitude afflicted almost all the medical personnel who stayed on. They missed meetings or canceled them, abandoned research, found excuses for not resuming the interrupted projects. Haitian doctors, he'd long ago discovered, learned early to accept all sorts of deficiencies, shortages of medicines, filthy hospitals. Perhaps it is a universal tendency to view the deaths of strangers philosophically. Haitian doctors had better cause for this failing than most others in medicine. Not surprisingly, they tended to shrug when patients died from ailments like measles or tetanus or TB. Farmer had put some of his best efforts into teaching his staff to expect more of themselves. Now, many were shrugging again. But the situation was far from hopeless, and he was glad to be back. Farmer was 35 now, on the rise in both medicine and anthropology. He had won his MacArthur. He was an infectious disease fellow in training at one of the world's best teaching hospitals, an assistant professor in medical anthropology at Harvard, and the author of 2 books and about 24 articles. He seems to have looked forward to a great deal more of the same, and he seems to have imagined that his main jobs now, and PIH's as well, were to repair Jean-Mille La Santé and keep expanding it. Partners in Health had changed their offices twice since 1987. They had finally acquired their own small headquarters building in Cambridge. The idea had been Jim Kim's, the money Tom White's. The staff there numbered only about 12, a little less than half volunteers, the rest underpaid employees. They managed an AIDS prevention program for Haitian teenagers in Boston and, in the rundown neighborhoods right next to the Brigham, a program for providing medical and social services to people who weren't getting any. They supported with small sums and advice a few public health projects in far-flung places, such as Chiapas in Mexico, and their research branch, dedicated to criticizing the status quo in international health, was assembling a book about the special worldwide vulnerability of impoverished women to AIDS. Women, Poverty, and AIDS, it was called. Hearing the title, a friend of Farmer's said, "That's what I like about your books, Paul. They have such cheerful subjects." One could hardly have called PIH Paul's Catholic Church anymore, but for all their cosmopolitan outlook, They were still just a small public charity with a substantial medical complex in Haiti, and Farmer seems to have felt that they were going to stay that way. In PIH's 1993 annual report, he'd written that they should never change their mission or soften their message in order to broaden their appeal. Accordingly, he wrote, they should resign themselves to a somewhat marginal status. But in fact, a big change in PIH was about to begin. They were about to become players in international health. Part 3. Médicos Aventureros. Chapter 13. A simple epidemiological map, a map based on what makes people sick and what kills them, and in what numbers and at what ages, could be coded in two colors. One would stand for populations who tend to die in their 70s, mainly from illnesses that seem like inevitable accompaniments to the aging of bodies. The other color would stand for groups who, on the average, die 10 and even 40 years earlier, often from violence and hunger and infectious diseases that medical science knows how to prevent and to treat, if not always to cure. On this map, the line dividing the two color-coded parts of humanity, what Farmer called the Great Epi Divide, epi being short for epidemiological, would partition many countries, many cities. Most of Haiti would wear the color of ill health, but parts of the hills above Port-au-Prince would be a patch of well-being. The map of the United States, by contrast, would depict a healthy nation speckled with disease. In Boston's Mission Hill neighborhood, right next to the Brigham, for instance, infant mortality is higher than in Cuba. In New York City's Harlem, a famous study from 1990 showed death rates for males between the ages of 5 and 65 were higher than in Bangladesh. Meager incomes don't guarantee abysmal health statistics, but the two usually go together. Many of the groups of people living on the wrong side of the Great Epi Divide have brown or black skin. Many are female. What they all have in common is poverty, absolute poverty, the lack of almost every necessity, clean water and shoes, medicine and food, in a place like Haiti. Relative poverty in a place like New York. For Farmer and Jim Kim and many others interested in the distribution of disease, tuberculosis vividly illustrated the Great Epi Divide, its contours, its causes, its effects. Improperly treated, or not treated at all, TB is dreadful and lethal, usually devouring the lungs but also sometimes other organs and sometimes the bones. Fortunately, an array of good and inexpensive first-line TB drugs existed. They had to be administered over the course of months, usually 6 to 8 months, but then they cured virtually every case. Thanks in part to those antibiotics, tuberculosis had all but vanished from the rich parts of the world. But the disease still plagued the poor parts to a degree most Americans and many Western Europeans would find hard to credit. At the end of the 20th century, TB was still killing about 2 million people a year, more adults than any other infectious disease except for AIDS, and TB shared what Farmer called a noxious synergy with AIDS, since an active case of one often makes a latent case of the other active too. In poor countries, TB was the most common proximate cause of death among people who died with AIDS, and yet, because tuberculosis mainly afflicted the poor side of the Epi Divide, the industrial nations and pharmaceutical companies had all but abandoned the search for new technologies to fight it. The tools for diagnosing the disease were antique. No large campaign had been launched to find a fully effective vaccine, and the newest of the anti-tuberculous drugs had been developed 25 years ago. Farmer liked to say that tuberculosis made its own preferential option for the poor. The aphorism contained a certain literal truth. According to the best current estimates, about 2 billion people, one-third of humanity, have TB bacilli in their bodies. But the disease tends to remain latent. It multiplies into bone-eating, lung-consuming illness in only about 10% of the infected. The likelihood of getting sick increases greatly, though, for those who suffer from malnutrition or various diseases, especially from HIV, itself by now predominantly a disease associated with poverty. Usually, active TB feeds on the lungs and spreads itself from them. sneezes and coughs, like the wind to its seeds. People who live in crowded peasant huts and urban slums and shanty towns and prisons and homeless shelters stand the best chances of inhaling the bacilli, of having their infections expand into active disease, and in some settings, of getting just enough treatment to make their TB drug-resistant. A person with active TB of the lungs harbors hundreds of millions of bacteria, enough to ensure that a small number will be mutants impervious to anti-TB drugs. In a patient who gets only one antibiotic or inadequate doses of several, or who takes the medicines erratically or for too short a time, the drug-susceptible bacilli may die off, while the drug-resistant mutants flourish. The patient becomes a site of rapid bacterial evolution, with drugs supplying the selective pressure. In the gravest cases, patients end up infected with bacilli that can't be killed by the two most powerful drugs. Medical science reserves a special name for tuberculosis of that sort: multi-drug-resistant TB, MDR by abbreviation. It is a scary disease, and a serious problem wherever it appears. But worst, of course, in the places with the fewest resources to deal with it. Multi-drug-resistant TB tends to arise where wealth and poverty are mingled, where poor people get some treatment, but not enough. It arises only infrequently in places of nearly universal poverty, like Haiti, where most people don't get treated at all. But by the mid-1990s, Farmer had dealt with several cases of MDR in Cange. The first had appeared during the time of the junta. He remembered the feeling of dread that washed over him when he realized what his patient had. And dread was justified. The young man died. Farmer blamed himself, but the fact was that treating MDR was tricky under the best of circumstances, and for a while, during the time of the junta, he simply couldn't get the necessary medicines to Cange. Since the death of that patient, he'd assembled the resources to fight the disease at Zomi La Santé, both the tools and the procedures. He was curing most of the cases that appeared sporadically in Cange when, in 1995, MDR claimed a close friend who had been living in a shantytown on the outskirts of Lima, Peru. Chapter 14. For several years during medical school, Farmer had boarded at St. Mary of the Angels, a parish run by a priest known as Father Jack. Farmer camped in a room under the eaves of the rectory. The church was in Roxbury, one of Boston's run-down neighborhoods, largely African-American. In the musty, dim, low-ceilinged sanctuary, gospel music surrounded the mass, and sermons had the feel of revival meetings. Jack Roussin, the priest, a beefy man with a florid complexion, would declaim on poverty and injustice, voices in the congregation calling out amens. Jack was the kind of priest whom nervous bishops call a character. He mediated arguments among neighborhood gangs, led candlelight vigils against drug dealing, carried signs in front of the state house protesting cuts in welfare. In his spare time, he liked to tell off-color stories and tease the young medical student upstairs. When Farmer began practicing vivisection, dog lab it was called at the medical school, he had a long talk with Jack about his misgivings, working on a creature he was going to have to kill. The next morning, Farmer awoke to what sounded like fingernails scratching on his door, then imitations of whinings, finally a few howls. Ophelia stayed at the rectory sometimes. She'd muss up the sheets in the room the nuns assigned her, then cross herself as she crept up the stairs to Paul's garret. Father Jack pretended not to notice, but he'd talk about Farmer's previous girlfriends in front of Ophelia just to see Paul blush. When Farmer created Partners in Health, he put Father Jack on the board of advisors. In the early 1990s, Jack left St. Mary's for a church in a place called Caraballo, a slum on the outskirts of Lima, Peru. On visits back to Boston, he kept telling Paul and Jim and Ophelia that PIH should start a project down there in his new parish. Jim Kim agreed eagerly. For about 8 years, Jim had happily served, very happily, he insisted, as Paul's second in command, or, as one member of the organization put it, PIH's bayaku, Creole for a person who picks up excrement. He'd answered the phone at PIH, helped Paul get medicines and appliances for Zombie La Santé, written grant proposals. When Paul had to get from the Brigham to a meeting, it was Jim who made sure he got there on time and who would escort him out of the hospital, saying, "Okay, Pell, we're in a hurry. Only one hug and two kisses per janitor." Now Jim wanted to do more. He wanted to learn how to do what Paul had done in Haiti. This book is continued on cassette 4.